Kulo chitam tata.
Nasmat kulo chitam tata.
Nasmat kalo chitam tata.
Nasmat kulo chitam tata.
Karmai tat tat vigahitam.
Karmai tat tat vigahitam.
Karmai tat sat viganitam.
Karmai tat sat viganitam.
Vado yadupa devanam.
Vado yadupa devanam.
Vado yadupa devanam.
Vado yadupa devanam.
Arabdaste kritainasam. Arabdaste kritanisam.
Arabdaste kritanisam.
Okay. Na.
Na.
Not.
Not.
Asmat kula.
Asmat
kula. Our family.
Our family.
Uchitam.
Uchitam.
Befitting.
Befitting.
Tata.
Tata.
My dear son.
My dear son.
Karma.
Karma.
Action.
Action.
Etat.
Etat.
This.
This.
Sat.
By authorities on religion.
Vigahitam.
Forbidden.
Forbidden.
Vadha.
The killing.
Killing.
Yat. Which.
Upadevanam.
Of the yakshas.
Arabda.
Was undertaken.
Take.
By you.
Akrita
enasam. Of those who are sinless. So this is Swayambhuva Manu, and he's the grandson, the grandfather of young Dhruva Maharaj, who's not a child anymore. He's already a man. He's already a king. He already has two wives and I think three or four children, more, maybe five. And he has just received news that his brother was killed by some yakshas, and he himself has gone there to chastise them very severely. And when he starts fighting with them, they realized that he was more powerful than them, and he was one, and they were 13,000. And they understood that he's more powerful than us. So they fought, and he killed so many of them, and then they ran. And they ran and returned to their city. And he decided that he wanted to visit their city. So for a Kshatriya, especially a warrior, especially one who's angry, to visit your city is not like a welcome. So they, in return, created so many mystical, illusionary, terrifying things to shake him. And he was somewhat shaken by these appearances of all sorts of horrible hallucinations. And the devas came and they assured him that he would be successful and that he should take shelter of the holy names, which he did. The mysticism disappeared, and he took his Narayan weapon, which he had earned, and he went to retaliate. So then he started to kill them with this powerful weapon that they would have no ability to withstand. And at that very point, Swayambhuva Manu, who was one of the lawgivers of humanity, there are 14 Manus appear in the day of Lord Brahma. And then he sleeps. So Lord Brahma, he does a lot of hard work. He has 12 hours sleep and 12 hours up. It's a little more sleep than we need. But his work is extraordinary. So in those, you could almost say every hour of his day and a couple of extra hours, a Manu appears. That Manu is the lawgiver of that particular hour of Lord Brahma's life. And to us, that's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. time that we really actually can't conceive of that amount of time. So therefore it seems a little bit to one who is not accustomed to the magnitude of the Vedic vision of reality, it seems like that's improbable, unbelievable, it doesn't gel well with the modern world's idea of history. It doesn't even gel well with their idea of prehistoric times and that we all came from monkeys and things like that. There's a lack of synchronicity between the Bhagavatam and modern education. So this makes it difficult for a normally well-educated person to understand the value of the Bhagavatam without doing what Dhruva Maharaj was instructed to do when he couldn't understand what was going on because of the mystical illusions in front of him. And that was take shelter of the holy names, because the holy name will make everything successful. So we too, it's healthy for us to become aware, conscious of what we can accept due to our piety, purity, and our deep faith, and what we think, oh, that's so hard to accept. Because if we think we're advanced in our understanding of Krishna consciousness, but actually we're not, because we haven't been tested yet. When we're tested, that's when we find out how advanced how solid our faith is. So before we're tested, when we haven't had that examination, we might think, I understand everything. But as we see with little children, when they go through exams, they realize I don't understand everything. So it's very helpful for us to understand what I don't understand. That feels a bit vulnerable, a bit uncomfortable to see what I don't understand. Shouldn't I just see what I do understand and stay there? And the answer is no. You have to have a much more balanced understanding. Otherwise, you might find yourself shaking like a leaf in the wind, when the tests of time and the tests of the material energy before you might be surprised at your first reaction. And your second reaction, of course, is that you have to take shelter of the holy names. And we need this perspective that the Bhagavatam so mercifully is projecting into the darkness of the ignorance of this modern, mechanistic, technical, iron age. It's the only thing that will prevent us from being asked to accept, which would be difficult for an intelligent devotee to do, that we're actually making progress as a society, when actually, in fact, we're being really pushed down. So we need to hear the negative, we need to see the negative, we need to understand the negative, but we don't need to remain negative. That's not our purpose, to make everybody feel negative. But because everything in this world it's a world of duality, because there are always two, if we know the both sides, then our knowledge is more complete. Or, as it's said in the Isopanishad, that one should learn the process of nescience of the process of transcendental knowledge side by side. Does that mean we should all go out and do some nonsense and learn about how nonsense works? And the answer is no, you don't have to do that, because you're probably already doing it. You're probably unaware of how much of the time your mind is actually engaging in matter. It's not engaging in spirit. And so the recommendation for us is you increase the spiritual, because the other part is going on automatically. And we think, well, I follow regulative principles. I'm a good person. Is that okay? And we say, no, that's called piety. And piety, Krishna speaks about in Bhagavad Gita, piety is very important. But piety and bhakti are very, very different. Piety is for my benefit. It will be good for me to do this right and that right. I do all the right things. I know that I'm going to get a very high destination because I've done so many good things. And bhakti is feeling more and more and more insignificant, more and more incapable, and this is the important part, and turning to Krishna, depending on Krishna, calling out to Krishna to supply what we lack. Piety can have a little pride about it, that we feel I don't lack anything, I'm a very good person. So then Krishna says, okay, then just to teach you a little lesson, not out of anything then other than love for you, I might put you in a situation where you can understand, oh, I do need you. I'm nothing without you. In the same way as a little spark, it flies out of a big fire. And now what is it? Before it was a little shining particle of fire, but poof, it goes over here, and what is it? It's almost extinguished. So here, Swayambhuva Manu is going to talk to Dhruva Maharaj, who will immediately submit because he's exalted, highly exalted. He will immediately submit to his grandfather and he will stop doing what he's doing. So he says, my dear son, the killing of the sinless yakshas which you have undertaken is not at all approved by authorities, and it does not befit our family, which is supposed to know the laws of religion and irreligion. So we know the laws of religion, we know the laws of irreligion, and I'm here to tell you that this, what you're doing, is comprised of irreligion. So don't do it. He says, my dear son, it has been proved that you are very much affectionate towards your brother. That's why he went out to say, you can't do this. This is against my brother. You've done this to my brother. If you did this to my brother, I'll show you what I'll do to you. You've proved that you're very much affectionate towards your brother and are greatly aggrieved at his being killed by the yakshas. But, just consider. For one yaksha's offense, you have killed many others who are innocent. So see, here he's an exalted devotee. In one sense, he can do nothing wrong because his consciousness is so high that if he does something a little incorrect by the examination of his superiors, he'll immediately stop that. So that makes him actually sinless, even though he may make a mistake. He will immediately stop it as soon as he recognizes it. So, before going on to the next verse, which has a purport, what really struck or brought my attention this morning was something that I always found a little mysterious, to tell you the truth, in its placement. And that is how at the beginning of this Leela of Dhruva Maharaj, almost second, third verse of this whole pastime, Sukadev Goswami, Maitreya Muni, diverts over to a little three, four verse, little section that he puts there first, where he describes all the characteristics of irreligion or adharma. So here, Dhruva Maharaj is being told, this is adharmic, don't do this. This is dharmic, this is adharmic. And here we are in a world where there is no such thing as adharmic. You can do whatever you want, so long as you don't get caught. If you get caught, then you need money. because money will help you to get out of a situation like that. And you'll need a lawyer who's trained to tell lies, and he will revert the truth in such a way as to get you out of that situation. So this can provide a sense of false confidence in the modern society, that I can get out of any situation and there's nothing that's right or wrong. That's old-fashioned. But here, let me go back to this section that I'm talking about, and you'll see how you can't escape this. Because you can say this is right and this is wrong, or it's not right, it's not wrong. But here, Lord Brahma, Maitreya, is describing another sun. He's described all the sons, Narada, and then there are nine rishis, seven rishis, Sapta rishis, and there are five other rishis who are celibate, who don't marry, they're not interested in materialism, Narada Muni goes from place to place, just enlightening little boys. He takes the little boys and he tells them, you should not grow up and become a materialistic person, you should become a great devotee. And when they grow up, they do go on to become kings. It's not like they necessarily leave the world, but they become Raja Rishis, a king who is also saintly. And this is the mercy of Narada, and this is what he does. And he doesn't have children that he has to worry about and educate and take care of. He simply travels around free. But Lord Brahma had another son. And his other son's name was Irreligion, Adharmasya. Now this fascinated me. Lord Brahma, how did that? Lord Brahma had a son who was Irreligion. He's supposed to be the greatest whatever, 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 so he can't have a son called Irreligion. Like, how can a devotee have a son who's irreligious? That doesn't follow. A devotee, next devotee, it's just simple. But it's not so simple. So let's hear. Another son of Lord Brahma was Irreligion, whose wife's name was Falsity. Irreligion and Falsity. And the shocking part to us, who are religious, is that Falsity was the sister of Irreligion. Irreligion, Falsity, brother and sister. And then they united in a marriage. So Srila Prabhupada points out that only Irreligion can do this. So today, in today's age, you see all the norms of relationships are all broken to pieces by the things that people are doing who are irreligious. And as the number of irreligious people increases, then they create ten of, out in this room, there's maybe one irreligious person sitting here. So we all look at that person with horror. That's terrible. But if all this side of the room was full of irreligious people looking back at you, and there was more of them than there were of you, you would start to shake a little bit. Because now they're all looking, and they're also looking at the deities and wondering whether they should sit here peacefully and watch the deities being worshipped because they're irreligious. So you would be shaking for yourselves and you'd be shaking on behalf of the deities, because now there's so many irreligious people in the room. So now there's so many irreligious people in the world. So you walk out of the temple room and you see them everywhere. So then you start to realize that as irreligion comes up and becomes more and more prominent, then those who are religious start to feel marginalized, minimalized, and these irreligious people make new rules because they're the majority. So let us continue. We've got Irreligion, who married Falsity, and they had two children named Bluffing and Cheating. Irreligion marries Falsity and gives birth to Bluffing and Cheating, who were also brother and sister, and they also got married. And they were taken by another demon named Nriti. So they were then born, and from them was born two more. Wait, let me get this right. Ruti, who had no children. From Dumba and Maya, that's cheating and bluffing, were born greed and cunning. And from their combination came children named Krodha, anger, and Himsa, envy. And from their combination were born Kali and his sister, harsh speech. From Kali and harsh speech were born death and fear. And from the marriage of death and fear were born excessive pain and hell. So what a wonderful family. Let me introduce them to you again. I'm going to do this to you again. Okay? So another son of Lord Brahma was irreligion, whose wife's name was falsity. From their combination were born two demons named Maya, cheating, and Dumba, or bluffing. These two demons were taken by a demon named Nuriti, who had no children. From Dumba and Maya were born greed and nikriti, or cunning. So greed and cunning. From their combination came children named Krodha, anger, envy, and from their combination was born Kali and his sister, harsh speech. O greatest of all good men, by the combination of Kali and harsh speech were born children named Mrityu, death, and fear. From the combination of Mrityu and fear came children named excessive pain and hell. Now I'm going to do this to you one more time, just so you get this right, so everybody knows, okay? We'll try it again. So the son of Lord Brahma was irreligion, and his wife's name was falsity. And they had two children named bluffing, and the other one was called cheating. So from bluffing and cheating came greed and cunning. Bluffing, cheating, greed and cunning. Don't you see these things outside? Wherever you go, in the advertising, even in the educational system that we put our children through, we see these things. Greed and cunning, from their combination came anger and envy. And from their combination were born Kali and, what was his sister's name? Harsh speech. From Kali and harsh speech were born the children known as death, yes, and fear. From the combination of death and fear came the children called excessive pain and hell. The next verse says, my dear Vidura, I have summarily explained the causes of devastation. These characteristics, all of them, they're causes of destruction, of devastation. They destroy. They're the opposite of dharmic qualities, which enhance. These characteristics destroy. They cause death, fear, excessive pain. One who hears the description three times, and you heard it three times, attains piety and washes the sinful contamination from his soul. So when I was thinking about this, long ago when I read this section of this pastime, I thought, how can you attain piety by hearing these horrible things? Right? death, fear, terrible things, negative things. How do you attain piety by this? And the answer, of course, is given in here, that by hearing about these enough, you don't want to do them. They're so horrible, you think, I don't want to be like that. I don't want those qualities in my heart. I don't want them for my children. I don't want them. And that produces piety. Because then what's the alternative? If you don't want these things, then you have to do something positive. So that's why we need to know the positive and the negative, the strengths and the weaknesses of our own selves. Because if we know the strengths and the weaknesses, then we have something that we keep saying to Krishna, these weaknesses, please, I don't want them. I may have them, they may be my companions on my journey of life, but from somewhere in me, some weak little part of me maybe, because I like them, they're part of me, but some part of me says I don't want them to be part of me. I want to increase my devotion. And it's hard to increase devotion. It's not easy. Of course it is easy. We can't say negative things about wonderful things. But we can say it's not hard. It's hard for us sometimes to increase our devotion. And one reason is because we associate very strongly with these characteristics in some form or another. And we don't have the strength to remove them, nor do we have the strength to increase our devotion. Both of those things are gifts. When we understand that, our bhakti can start to blossom. And both the ability to develop our attentive love for Krishna and to integrate that, and to weave that into our day-by-day activities, and the ability to lessen our interest in these things that we've just heard about, in whatever shape or form they come, it's a gift of Krishna. I won't be asking for that gift if I don't think I need it. Krishna doesn't sort of put gifts outside your door that you come out and you open the door and see it and you push it to the side and keep going with your life. It's not our order provider. It's our responsibility to bow down to him. Not that he should provide and provide and provide for us. He will provide, and he's always providing, but the problem is we don't see it that way. So here's Dhruva Maharaj, and he's being corrected. This is irreligious, this is religious, don't do this. And he's acting within the boundaries of his duty. He's not doing something. He didn't go to a nightclub. He didn't go and eat something non-veg. He was doing his duty, but his grandfather came and said, stop, don't do this now. And he explained to him why also. You will disturb Kuvera because the yakshas are upadevatas. That means the yakshas are a little bit above human beings. They're a little below devatas. They have all this mystic power. They're in another category. And if you disturb them, you disturb Kuvera, who is their master. And this will not be good. It will not be good in any way. Plus, they are innocent in the sense that they did nothing to you. So do not disturb them. So, for one yaksha, he was ready, he was brave enough to go and attack their kingdom, to show, I am the king, and if you do something wrong, I will immediately be there to punish you. So do not disobey at least my kingdom's rules, do not interfere. And then he will very quickly return to his natural submissiveness as a devotee. This we must also learn to do as well, especially when we have a role of responsibility over someone else. We have to be able to be firm and very quickly return to our mood of being a servant. It's not easy. This is at least my experience. we will find our tests along the way, but we should still continue on this path, because this is the way through the darkness of Kali Yuga. And if you don't think it's dark, you boys are having a wrestling match over there. If you don't think it's dark now, you just wait. They've got lots more things. Maya and bluffing have got lots more things in store for the world around us that we see. So make your way back to a mindset of surrender in every situation. And as quickly as possible also, as does is the example of Dhruva Maharaj. Make your way back and learn how to do that. And your Krishna consciousness will become very stable by doing that. And you'll be able to help others who may be far out into the darkness and have no idea that what they're looking at is threatening or will harm them. You may be able to help them also to make their way back. So I'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, please. Yes. Why did Dhruva Maharaj kill many yakshas? Why didn't he just kill the one who killed his brother? I'm going to make a guess, which you're not supposed to do, but it's just so you know that I'm just guessing. But it may be that he was not sure which one was the one who killed his brother. So he went there to retaliate, and they sent out their armies. They didn't send out one, they sent out so many. So then he said, okay, if you're all coming to fight with me, I'll fight with all of you. So in fighting with all of them, perhaps he killed the one who killed his brother. Maybe he didn't have the opportunity to go find him. They would not let him into their city. So that was his decision. Good question. Any other good questions?
I was hearing one lecture from Srila Prabhupada. He said we are wasting so much time learning the material things. Material things, you know, all material. But about transcendental knowledge, we have exactly no knowledge at all.
Yes.
We are completely in itself, completely in dark.
Yes.
Because soul is always looking for pure love. So, besides chanting, how else we can improve our devotion?
Well, Krishna, we were listening on the weekend at the mini Govardhan retreat to the pastime where the Brahmanis from Mathura left their families and came to Krishna. They left everything, and they did it with a total, fearless, absolute unwillingness to ever go back. They were finished with everything of their lives except Krishna. They had their focus was so high, their love was so high. And Krishna had come nearby, and when they heard that Krishna was nearby, and also that he was hungry and nearby, they took everything, they took everything to feed him, even the food that was meant for their husbands. But they didn't do it with a malice or a selfishness. They did it because they gave up an inferior thing for a superior thing. So if somebody is fortunate enough to understand the difference between an inferior thing and a superior thing, then they don't have to waste any time in learning all sorts of mundane things and going through the process of taking a mandala, a birth, and then going through the mundane systems given by the mundane world, and so on and so on and so forth. Because they have such resolve, and they don't care what happens to them, they only care to serve Krishna. That's 100%. So those people are very, very, very rare, incredibly rare. So then the next is us, right, who are wasting our time doing so many mundane things and hardly have any time for Krishna. What do we do? And the question is really for us. Well, we then have to follow the instructions that Krishna gave them when he sent them home. The last thing they wanted to do was go back. Because to them it was going back into ignorance, it was going back into the company of people who were not interested in Krishna consciousness, it was going back into subservience to their husbands who had rejected Krishna's request for something to eat. So they were so unwilling to go back. And plus, they were so grateful that now they had seen Krishna with their very eyes. So sometimes it is said that until you see Krishna, you can't give up material life. And Srila Prabhupada explains, for example, that the deity is here. This Krishna comes in this form because we can't see him with these eyes. These are, Prabhupada calls them sometimes, fleshy eyes. We're very proud of our fleshy eyesight, but he says this is not very significant in trying to actually see Krishna. You can't see him with these eyes. So he comes in this form that's made of stone or wood or paper or something, and he allows you to see him. We have a tendency to see him as there, but when we go out the door and we go on with our lives, we go into our own world. Right? We all go into our own world. And in my world, who's in the center? Me. So I'm picking and choosing from the material world what's good for me, helpful for me, how I can do this, how I can do that, what I want, how I want to live, what I want to eat, so on, my health. Everything is about me. So those ladies were on a far away from that platform. But Krishna told them, as he would later tell Arjuna, that when you go back, do it for me. Do it for me. And then he said to them even, he said, you know, I am the Yajna Purush. It's in the Vedas that you should do this yajna. So even though their husbands were doing a yajna for going to heaven, that's not Krishna Bhakti. But he told the wives, when you go back and you sit beside them to complete this yajna that you don't want to have anything to do with, you think Krishna is the Yajna Purush, and he said, do this yajna for me. So I'm doing this thing that he is doing for another reason. I'm doing this thing for Krishna. And this is a very refined consciousness that we must learn ourselves and teach to others, or else there'll always be a divide. There's the temple where we go Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and then we walk out the door and Krishna lives in the temple, and as soon as we go out, everything is for me. And we won't make very much progress like that. We will, but it will be slow. Whereas if we get this concept clear, that everything belongs to Krishna. When I'm studying matter, I'm studying Krishna's material energy. When I'm working and getting money, that's Krishna's power, Lakshmi. Whatever I'm doing, I'm actually interacting continuously with Krishna. When we come to that level, even the beginning of that level of understanding, that idea, then we're no longer doing this, something for me and something for Krishna. We're now trying to see Krishna in everything. And that's the beginning. And Krishna says, for one who sees me everywhere, sees everything in me, I'm never lost. And he's never lost to me. So the study of matter, when you take it and you get involved in it, in and of itself is darkness because it's unlimited. They can study a piece of grass and they can go on understanding. There are deeper and deeper, deeper ways. And they're so proud in Kali Yuga because the light above is blocked, just like in Melbourne on a rainy day. The sun is not shining. It is shining, but it's above the clouds. So the cloudiness of Kali Yuga is such that it keeps everybody's vision down. They can't see above the cloud. So they're looking instead at all the matter, the phenomena. And they're doing phenomenal things with phenomena. They're doing phenomenal things. They're nanotechnology, they're this, they're that. Some of it we believe, some of it we don't believe. But they're doing so much work because everybody's attention is on matter. Studying it like never before with all sorts of machines. So we're making progress, yes? And Prabhupada says, no. You're just getting more and more material knowledge, material this, material that. And you're neglecting to put Krishna in there, in your material activities. Krishna, you're not planting him there firmly somehow or other in the center. This is our challenge. And it's the same challenge in the temple, working in the temple, as it is working in the world outside. It's a little easier, because you don't have the blaring materialistic influences attacking you at every moment. But you still have one of these. And this is where this is the repository of lifetimes of material desires and conceptions. They're all stored up here. If this was cleared, gone, then when you walk outside, nothing would particularly attract you. You'd be like if you take a small child and you take them somewhere, like in the middle of the heart of the city in some kind of awe, or to a football match where everybody is frenzied with their sensation of success or gain or loss and so on. This little child would be sort of sitting there looking at everything. These people jumping up and down, these people crying, rolling on the ground. You know, what are they doing? You wouldn't understand it. So we would be innocent like that if this was removed. Then we could just walk through the world as Narada Muni did. He went one place, another place, another place, another place, and he gained experience of everything, but he didn't start accumulating many, many desires. He's like, oh, that's how it works. Next. And not that he was really thinking like that, he was the whole time interested in his meditation. But we must become more and more seriously like that if we want to make the amount of progress that we deserve to make in our life.
Thank you very much. I had a question you already answered. Pupdevanam, you already told.
What's that?
Pupdevanam.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Why do I feel that Krishna is not giving me those two gifts enough? How do I ask for it?
Well, you know, today, why don't you today do just imagine, this is an illusion, but it's not altogether true. Imagine you're sitting beside yourself throughout a whole day and observe where your mind goes throughout the day, because I read somewhere, I'm not sure where it came from, but I saw it yesterday and it made me uncomfortable, and I don't know if it was from Srila Prabhupada or from another source, but I collected it, and it was a quote, perhaps Srila Prabhupada saying, in the morning you study Srimad Bhagavatam, you read 1 hour, 2 hours, what about the other 22 hours? Mostly one's engaged in material activities. It's a state of consciousness. It's not that spiritual activities, even spiritual activities can be done, isn't it? You can read a book and say, what did you read? I don't know. Because I'm not there intently behind my prayers. So I can't speak for you, but I can speak for myself. And I kind of feel like I must be around about average, that I make a prayer and the next minute I get distracted by that. Oh, look at that. Something distracts me. Sometimes I get distracted about learning something. and I start learning it more than I need to learn it because I like learning it. Or sometimes I get distracted by somebody's sad story. Or I get distracted by something horrible happening that I hear about in the world outside. But I get distracted very easily from this single-minded prayer. So I've learned to accept it, although I can't guarantee it's true for everyone, but I've learned to accept that to the degree that I'm praying, I'm getting that much reciprocation. And so if I pray more, I also need to know what to pray for, but if I'm more intent on the mood that I'm trying to do in my praying mood, if I do that more, and if I do it more refinedly, not just praying things like, oh, please I can't cope, please get rid of this difficult situation, or please, my financial, not you of course, my financial situation, please I need more something. If my prayers are more directly spiritual, I'm developing confidence that Krishna is waiting for me. He's waiting for me. He's actively waiting for me. Like if I was answering you and you were playing with a little girl there, I'd be going, Janitai, trying to get your attention again. So he's trying to get our attention again, but our attention easily wanders like a small child easily wanders. So when I look at little children wandering around, or the other day I was walking down the street where we're staying and there was a lady two doors down who had a very small dog, about this big, about that high. And as soon as we came by, the dog started jumping around. I was so excited. I think when I see something like that, I think, that's what my mind does. It jumps up and down. Something. Or a child wandering. My mind has characteristics like that. So I pray that these things may lessen in favor of a deeper, more strong surrender to Krishna. But am I then allowed to say I did my prayer? Now let me go and jump around outside or play like a child? You can if you want, but then I tell myself, you could do that if you want, but you're not going to get very far with your prayer because you counterbalance it each time with the same behavior that you're asking to get rid of. So then I see, oh, then it's not easy to make progress. We come with certain material karma. Yes. And that is why, interestingly enough, Lord Brahma creates irreligion. It's not that he creates a religion, but he creates the whole, he brings the creation into place again, and the living entities that are coming into it as a continuity, they have a need for irreligion. Why? Because they want it. He's not able to say, sorry, you can't have that, you can only have this. He creates the environment and then the living entities, by the nature of the blessings of the Lord within the heart, they're allowed to actually play out their desires. So I need to understand my responsibility, which is to continuously make effort to become what I say I want to become. And not in a forced, horrible, terrible way, because I watched the lady tell that dog, sit. And the dog wouldn't sit because it was so excited. And then she said, heel. And the dog wouldn't move over. And I said, is your dog trained? She said, usually. So the dog was trained and trainable and trained, but in certain circumstances it was excited. So then I could understand, okay, so our minds are also like that. We may get a little bit, then we bring it back. Gently bring it back. We don't have to whip it. We're learning. We're becoming trained. We bring it back. We try again. And we keep trying. And we shouldn't give up. Krishna's never going to give up on you. So we shouldn't give up either. Do you have further to add?
Yeah. So you mentioned mind. So
Not yours, the dog's.
But referring back to the two gifts, I don't have the ability to calm down my mind.
Yes. What is Krishna giving you? He's giving you, first of all, what he gives you is he gives you the clarity. He says, I'm seated in everyone's heart. For me comes remembrance, forgetfulness, knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So he gives you the knowledge to how to do it. And those moments when you suddenly get an insight, you should immediately stop for a second and say 108 thank yous. Because that wasn't you who did that. And he gives you the remembrance. Hang on, I'm not supposed to be jumping around right now. Quick, come sit down. And he gives you the ability to gently resit. If you do everything very severely, that usually means that you think you're doing it. I'm performing austerities to control my mind and this and this and this. It's very hard to do that in Kali Yuga because you'll be defeated by so many inimical forces of material energy which will attack you. So what Krishna does is he gives you steps towards that. He gives you development of that. And if you can look back a year and see, I have made progress, that's a gift from Krishna. We say thank you many times. And if I look back and find I used to be like this and I'm like this right now, then he's giving you the gift of remembrance. I used to be like that. And you've given me the gift of forgetfulness so that I could wander away a bit. I want now, please give me the gift of remembrance so I can return. And you can return. That's his kindness also. He can give you the strength to return. And if you find you're not returning, then you have to pray, please help me to use my present state of consciousness and situation so that I can advance. I may not go back to who I was when I was 18 and had no headaches and no problems or anything like that, but now let me look forward to what example I can see of somebody who's in this stage of life and let me advance in that way. So that's him who gives you those intuitions, those thoughts. They're not necessarily going to be there unless you have that sense of prayer. But when we say something in a prayer, please help me to control my mind, we do need to know what we're asking. Please help me to control my mind. What are you asking? And what's your time frame on this? Do you want somebody to take out your mind and do a quick clean and pop it back in? What's your concept, your idea of what this please help me to control my mind means? And so what happens is we get disappointed because our prayers, we're asking for things that take lifetimes. And we want them sort of quick, because that's the way the world works. I want that over, take care of that, please. Thank you. What's next? Okay, take care of that. We're efficient here, you know. It doesn't work like that. It's a gradual process of cleansing that Krishna consciousness provides, but it's an amazing process of cleansing, unique to itself. There's nothing else that can do what Krishna consciousness can do, because Krishna consciousness means at the end you'll be conscious of Krishna, not conscious that I have a really good memory now, not conscious that now I can sit for hours and do some yoga or something, but I'm conscious of Krishna. I feel my connection with him. I'm a part of him. That's what we want. And if we don't want that, that's what we should want. Because that's natural, that's our natural position. And if we feel like sometimes, wow, I'm so lost, I don't want anything like that, I'm just really a horrible fallen person, that's also not bad. Because then from that position we say to Krishna, oh, you know, I have to sit here and talk the Bhagavatam, I'm such a fallen soul, how can I do this? And then what happens is Srila Prabhupada, the deities say, no, we'll give you the words to say. And when you stand up and walk away from here, you try to apply those words. And that is our association, what we give to each other as devotees. Does that make... Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna. All right, so I'll let you all get on with your days. And see you tomorrow. Hare Krishna.